From the National Endowment for the Arts, this is Artworks. I'm Josephine Reed. Heard saxophonist, composer, bandleader, and 2023 NEA Jazz Master, Kenny Garrett. For more than 30 years, Kenny Garrett has received critical recognition for his musical versatility, rooted in jazz but effortlessly incorporating post-bop and smooth jazz, as well as soul, rhythm and blues, and world music. Influenced first by John Coltrane and then by Pharoah Sanders, Kenny's compositions often pay homage to his ancestors and mentors in jazz, while still being absolutely contemporary and uniquely his own. Kenny Garrett began his career performing with the Duke Ellington Orchestra and then the Mel Lewis Orchestra. In 1987, Garrett began working with Miles Davis, a collaboration that lasted for 5 years until Davis's death. With more than 20 recordings as a leader, as well as appearing on more than 230 as a sideman, Kenny Garrett has performed and recorded with a who's who of musical icons, including Art Blakey, Ron Carter, Miles Davis, Chick Corea, Freddie Hubbard, and Pharoah Sanders, among many, many others. And Kenny Garrett maintains an enviably busy touring and recording schedule with his own band, as well as with some of the world's most acclaimed jazz legends. I sat down with Kenny Garrett back in October at New York City's acclaimed Blue Note Jazz Club, which graciously opened their doors to us so we might film our interview there during the day. So occasionally you'll hear the background noise of a club getting ready for the evening's performance. But it was still a perfect place for a conversation, and Kenny and I began at the beginning with the place of music in his childhood home.
I was born in Detroit, Michigan. My brothers and sisters played music also, but they didn't take it to the level I took it. So there we had a family band where my sister played violin, my other sister played piano, my brother played drums, and my other sister played organ. So we had a band. We started that way.
Amazing. What kind of music were you playing? What music was in your home as you were growing up?
Oh, wow. There was a lot of music in my home. You know, being from, you know, from Detroit, my mom was listening to Motown sounds and my father was listening to jazz. So I heard people like Mahalia Jackson, James Cleveland, Aretha Franklin, The Temptations. I used to go down to the Fox Theater to watch those shows because my mom wanted me to be a singer, per se. But I love the saxophone.
And when did you start to play? And why the saxophone in this, you know, with all the instruments in the world, why that one?
Well, you know, I started playing the saxophone because my stepfather, Benny, he played saxophone as a hobby. And so I liked the smell of the case, which is strange. There was a velvet interior, and I used to love the smell of that case, the interior. And I would sit by my stepfather, Benny, and just listen to him practice. So he got me my first horn, which is really a plastic toy saxophone. And I started playing around the house like most kids would do. Then he bought me a horn years later, but I wasn't really trying to be a musician. I just loved the smell of this case. And I would just sit by my stepfather and listen to him play.
But then when he got the horn for you, you took to it? Or were you hoping you'd get a case of your own and that you'd
well,
be happy
no,
that
not
way?
That. No, I think really what happened at that point is this. He taught me the G major scale, and then he sent me to a music school. And that was the beginning of it. And then I just started taking private lessons. I didn't play in school. I just kind of played around the house. I wasn't really trying to be a serious musician at that time. That didn't really happen until I got into high school.
And what happened in high school that made you decide you wanted to be a serious musician?
I met my high school band director, Bill Wiggins, and that's what changed everything. He saw something in me that I didn't see. He took me on his wings, and everything I wanted to learn, he taught me. I mean, he became my private instructor, you know, private lessons I took from Mr. Wiggins. He taught me so much about life, you know, and about music. I mean, matter of fact, he gave me one of my first gigs that I was playing with an organist by the name of Lyman Woodard. He was one of the popular organ players in Detroit, and he used to play with Lyman Woodard. So he actually gave me that gig. And so when I would play the gig, it were late sets. I would get home maybe like 3 o'clock in the morning. And my first class was Mr. Wiggins' class at 8 o'clock in the morning. And so when I would show up late for these classes, he said, don't show up late for my classes. But he knew that I was tired, but he said, don't show up. That was the kind of the discipline that I needed to learn. He was just telling me so many things. Matter of fact, at one point he told me about, I didn't want to come to New York. I wanted to stay in Detroit and be a Detroit musician. He said, no, the C7 is the same around the world. And so that was encouraged me, like, you can go any place in the world if you can play a C7. You don't have to just stay in Detroit.
There's learning to play, and there's learning charts and getting the foundation of music. And then there's getting to the heart of music, to the spirit of music, to finding your own sound and developing that. And I'm curious how that process worked for you, that development of your own sound.
Well, I think, you know, first thing I would have to speak about is one of my mentors used to call me the preacher. And I think I heard a record of John Coltrane. It was called The Blowing Session. And it was with Hank Mobley, Johnny Griffin, Art Blakey, Lee Morgan, a whole bunch of great musicians. And Johnny Griffin was playing. He was beautiful. He was playing all these fast things. And Train came in. He went, bah! That changed my life. It changed my life.
He played one note.
He played one note. And when I heard this one note, that was always my quest. I wanted to find one note that would touch people. I wanted to play a note that even God would say, that's a beautiful note. And so that's what I was searching for. Once I heard that one note that Coltrane played, I was searching for that, searching. And then I started to realize that all of my heroes, Duke Ellington, he had his own sound. Thelonious Monk had his own sound. Coltrane had his own sound and his own music. And it was my quest. I wanted to find this beauty. I was searching for a sound. And then I remember I was playing with the Ellington band, and Harold Minert, who was a lead alto player, he called me. He played a tape for me. It was a song I used to play a solo on called Broadway. And I said, that's my sound. That's my sound. Then I realized I had a sound. But I wanted my sound to pierce people's soul. I wanted to speak to people when I played. And the reason I mentioned the preacher, because coming full circle, I realized that's really what I'm doing. In some way, I'm a preacher on my saxophone. I'm playing notes, and I'm playing these notes to reflect the spirit of being in church or the hymns. That's what I'm looking for, and that's what I've been, you know, doing all these years. And in turn, I was able to find my sound through that, even though my first influence were people like Hank Crawford and Glover Washington and Cannonball Alley. So I would say I was always on the quest to find my voice, especially after Harold Minert. I understood that there was a possibility for that.
You were a baby when you started with the Duke Ellington Orchestra. Right. Didn't you begin right out of high school?
That's correct. I was up-and-coming saxophonist in Detroit. Marcus Belgrave, who's a pillar of the community, knew of me and my teacher, so they recommended me. So I ended up just going out. I thought I would just go out and play a little bit, but I ended up playing in the band for 3.5 years. It was a great experience.
It's like going to the University of Duke Ellington.
Oh, for sure. It's so many people that helped me. But the Ellington Band was a very crucial moment for me because I learned how to blend. I learned how to blend with 18 musicians. In turn, I learned how to blend when I played with Miles Davis. I learned how to make it one horn. I learned how to blend with Freddie Hubbard. So every time I would play with anyone, it was always about one instrument.
You worked with many bands, with Mel Lewis, mm-hmm. and with the Danny Richmond Quartet, and then Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers, which, seriously, I think almost every jazz master I have spoken with had some time in the Jazz Messengers. Can you talk about that experience and what you learned from Art Blakey?
Well, what I learned with Art Blakey was how to build a solo. You had two courses. That's like two times around the song. And the second course, he would do a press roll, and you had to make, you'd finish your statement. But mainly, art was teaching us how to be leaders. I mean, he allowed us to take the mic. He allowed us to direct the band. So he was teaching us how to be leaders. Sometimes, you know, arrangers, you know, he was just teaching us to be a complete musician. I mean, it was an honor just to be in that band, you know, because you think about the saxophone chair, you know, having people, I mean, Benny Golson, having Wayne Shorter, NEA Jazz Master Donald Harrison, Billy Pierce, it was Branford Marcellus, NEA Jazz Master Branford Marcellus. So it was all these musicians who came through there, so you get a chance to the experience, to have that same experience.
When did you move to New York?
I moved to New York and around 80, I started doing, subbing on the Broadway show, Sophisticated Ladies. Also, I wasn't a regular, so I also started playing with Mel Lewis Orchestra at that time. That was a great band. It was great for me to really just be able to be in the band for a while and to absorb that, because I went on to play with other bands, you know. When I first moved to New York, I was really playing in a whole bunch of bands like Lionel Hampton, Frank Foster, all these great musicians. And so I got a chance to be around those musicians and play this music.
How did you end up with Miles? How did that come about?
Well, actually, I auditioned for a French movie with a tenor saxophonist by the name of Gary Thomas. He came in, he said, well, are you interested in playing with Miles? Because he's looking for an alto player. So, of course, I'd love to play with Miles. So he gave me Miles's number. I called Miles up. He wasn't there. He had his valet was there. He said, call back. You know, Miles called me back later, and he said, well, send me some music. So I sent him some music. I think I had some music. I played with Art Blakey and the Jazz Messenger, my own music, which was a little commercial. So I sent it to him, and he said, Kenny, you sound like you're wearing Sonny's dirty drawers. And that was the beginning. So I went out to do like four gigs with Miles, and I thought that was it. And I ended up joining the band. And my first experience with Miles was really interesting. My microphone never worked. First few gigs playing with Miles, my microphone didn't work. And I remember when he finally heard me, he was wearing his sunglasses. And I was wearing sunglasses because I was trying to be like Miles. He took off my sunglasses and he looked at me to say, there's something beautiful coming out of this saxophone. And that was the start of that. It started with Miles. And we had a great experience because, you know, with Miles, we had a kind of call and response that wasn't taught. It was basically, he played a line, I played it back. He didn't tell me. I just thought that's what I was supposed to do. I didn't know the rules, or I didn't have a blueprint of what to do. So he played it back, I played it, and I was learning this language like an African tradition. People said, you know, what was Miles teaching? He taught me every day because I was learning his language by, you know, playing it. And I remember hearing him tell Herbie one day, he said, Herbie, Kenny's playing all of my licks and the wrong ones too. I like the wrong ones too. I like all those notes were good to me.
After Miles passed, you began your own group, and I wonder if you can speak a little bit to the differences between being a leader and being a sideman. And I think there's probably joy in both and challenges in both.
Well, the challenge of being a leader, a band leader, I think is, as a sideman, you don't have to do all the other things a sideman don't know about by doing interviews, or why the sidemans are sleeping, the leader's out doing things. I'm usually out doing interviews or some music I have to work on. There's something I'm doing on to make sure everything is okay. But the difference between playing with Miles is that that was first class, so I didn't have to do anything but just show up to the gig. With my band, it was different. I had to do everything because I was up and coming. Even though I played with Miles, that was Miles' situation. Now I had to create my own situation. And so I started, you know, from the bottom. And even though I played with Miles, I had to start and start building, playing in different halls that weren't the big halls that Miles played in. And I had to build up to it. And I was down for it. I knew to some point I would have to do that. And so I just started just trying to get musicians with me who I thought would be able to play my music. And then I started also trying to think about conceptually how I wanted the music to be. So I knew that my influences at that time were people like, McCoy Tyner and Woody Shaw. I had been in, you know, playing music with them, so I really wanted to keep that, some people call it spiritual jazz. I wanted to keep that kind of music going.
Well, Farrah Sanders is another person. In fact, we're sitting in the Blue Note. This is the place where you first played with Farrah.
That's correct. Yeah.
Another NEA jazz master. Talk about that playing that you did with him. You made beautiful music with him.
Well, you know, and Farrah and I were actually coming from the same spiritual place. I love his playing because he was organic. It wasn't really about playing the changes, you know, like completely, but it was about his spirit and his notes. And like I said earlier in the interview, that's what I was searching for, this note, this one note. I was really honored because Farrah stood on the bandstand with John Coltrane, and I could stand on the bandstand with him. So we started to develop our relationship really just by, I would show up at his concerts or his gigs, and he would say, "Where's your horn? Don't show up without your horn." I guess he really wanted me to experience it on the bandstand. And so eventually I started showing up and I would play with him. And I started to understand, you know, the music better. I guess he understood that I wanted to go to the place he was going. And so he invited me into his world. And I learned so much from Farrah, the way I introduced the band. It's like Farrah, the way I would play, especially in the beginning of my band, I would play longer songs to experiment with the harmony. I learned so much from Farrah about how you bring the audience in to this music. That was my go-to person to really learn, and how to pick songs. And the spiritual part is really what I loved, you know, about Farrah.
Well, when you're performing live, it's such an exhilarating experience for the audience. And I wonder if you can talk about the energy from the audience. Does that become almost a call and response for you when you're performing? And does it create a heightened feeling for you as you create for the audience?
Well, I think it's important to receive energy from the audience, but I always come to play. If there are two people in the club, I come to play. Because I just feel, Art Blakey used to tell us, you know, the music comes from the creator to the musician, to the audience. So the thing is that if there's one person, we don't know if that's the person who's just hearing Kenny Garrett for the first time. I can't really hold back, I have to play. It doesn't really matter what situation, I just come to play. Even if it's a sound check, I'm playing.
You began composing very early. How do you begin a piece of music? What inspires it? A melodic line, an image? All of the above, it depends on the day.
Well, how I start compositions are usually from the piano. I've written a whole bunch of songs in different keys, so I'll just sit at the piano and I might just play a chord. And this chord might conjure up something. Or maybe something, a melody that comes up first, and I'll keep working on that melody. Or I might develop the chords on the piano. There's just so many different ways I write. It's not one way. It's sometimes a melody that I hear on the saxophone, and then I'll go to the piano and put that in and try to work that out. Or sometimes it might be in a dream. I might hear a melody, but I hear it and I, you know, write what I'm hearing. And I try, sometimes harmonically I'll change, you know, chords. What I'm looking for ultimately is really, does that composition make me feel good? And if a composition feels good to me, then that's when I present it.
Do you leave room when you write for your musicians to put themselves into it? How much instructions do you give? How much space do you give?
Initially, the only instructions that I give to the musicians is to conceptually understand the music. So what that means is that when I'm writing a composition, I have them in mind. And then I'm not teaching them by music, even though I read music and write music. I teach them the music. That way I don't lose the feeling of the music. And when I give it to them, once we play the music enough and I know that they understand the concept of the music, then we can start to move. I want them to have that experience. I learned it from Miles. Miles wasn't saying, you do this, you do this. It was just, he wants you to understand it, you know? And so that's what I do with my music. I don't really try to say it's only this, but as long as you conceptually understand it, then we can move together. And, you know, with my latest CD, Sounds from the Ancestors, exactly what happened. You know, they heard it, but now we're taking it to another place. We can move it to what I heard originally.
You have so many musical dialects that you speak in your own voice. I'm not sure how, but but you manage to do this. You know, it can be some hip-hop, some R&B, Afro-Cuban. And Asian music has long been an influence on you, and your album Beyond the Wall is probably your fullest expression of that. What's the draw to Asian music? And talk a little bit about Beyond the Wall.
I've always had a love for the Asian country, Japan, China, and Korea. I have the backup. I was going to Europe 1 year, and I heard someone say, Americans are lazy. They don't speak any language, you know. So I decided I'm going to get a tape and learn Japanese. That was like my first introduction to the Asian culture. And so I started learning Japanese by tape and books. And it really, when I would play in clubs, I would see Japanese people and I would start speaking. So I always had an affinity for Asian language. That actually trickled down to not only the Japanese, because on Happy People, I did Asian medley, where I did a Japanese song, I did a Korean song, and I wanted a Chinese one, but I didn't know any at that time. I learned it after that. So I was always searching for that. But you know, what I was looking for, the spring, the spiritual spring that comes through the music. I started learning Japanese folk songs, and I loved the melody. But it was the same as listening to a Negro spiritual or the hymns. I was looking for that same stream in all the music. If it was Japanese, if it was Korean, if it was Turkish, I was always looking for that. So how I ended up doing Beyond the Wall is how, which is crazy. I went to a music store looking for a violin book. So I saw this Arhu book, which is a two-string violin book. And I bought this book, went back home. I was practicing out of this book. I said, wow, this Chinese book sounds like African music. It's weird. I had to go to China to figure it out. So I went there to study Chinese music, traditional music. Now it's full circle. Now the Chinese music sounds like African music. African music sounds like Chinese music. And then I figured, well, it's the pentatonic scale. So that was a lesson that I learned from searching for this Chinese music. But when I did decide to do Beyond the Wall, I wanted to use Mogul Miller, Bobby Hutcherson, Pharoah Sanders, my man, Brian Blade, and Bob Hurst. When I play with the elders, I try to find a music to inspire them because they played everything. So you don't want to just give them some generic thing. So when they heard that Arhu, they lost their mind. And I knew that they would be inspired. It was just really, you know, something that I had to do. And it's just really part of that search of my love for the Asian culture.
You joined Chick Corea, Christian McBride, John McLaughlin, and Vinnie Caluto, 4-5-piece band. And you won a Grammy with 5-piece band.
That's right. Yeah, I won a Grammy with a 5-piece band.
How did this band come together?
Well, the 5-piece band came together because, you know, Chick had been looking for me for a while. And so I knew years out, because, you know, Chick does a lot of projects, that it was coming. And then when he called me and said, well, we're going to do the 5-piece band, and he told me about the musicians, I was thinking, well, maybe I can contribute some music, but I didn't know what direction it was going to be. And it was a lot of music that Chick was writing and John was writing. It was hard music in some ways, because I remember playing it, and we had, like, these written parts that you had to play in, like, in unison. And I was thinking, wow, that's a lot of music. But I don't like to read music. I read music, but I like to after 2 weeks of playing this music, I had to find another way because reading music stops my creativity. So I needed to take my eyes off of the sheet music and started playing the music. So after about 2 weeks, I started just learning the music, you know, by memory. But I mean, the experience of playing with John and Chick, I mean, I learned so much from John because we used to sit in the back of the bus and we would share our love for languages. Now, at this time, I was learning Chinese. He used to teach me about Indian ragas. He was a teacher, he was an educator. So I was sitting in the back of the bus and hang out with John and we would talk about life. But I have to talk about the brotherhood of Chick and I. He just wants to learn. He just wants to play. And I think that's what he saw in me, that I love to play. We were friends on the bandstand and off the bandstand. It was just basically, it's his love for music, and we share that. We just come to the same place. And I think that's why we got along too well. We're different ways, but we're still approaching it from that spirit. He's looking for that too.
At that point in our interview, Ravi Coltrane, John's son, and a brilliant musician in his own right, arrived at the Blue Note, bringing with him his father's soprano saxophone. And it turned out, Kenny had history with that particular instrument.
The story with that is that when I was in high school, and Dora Roberts, I used to go over to his house. He used to say that his uncle was John Coltrane, and I didn't believe him. But I used to go to his house, and I would play the soprano. And so one day he was in Queens, and he called me and said, well, I'm at my cousin Robbie's house. This is when I realized that was the truth. And I just stopped and said, wow, I used to play John Coltrane's soprano. So then I was thinking about the horn for this situation. I was thinking, well, it would be nice if we could get that horn.
So Kenny called his good friend Ravi, who brought his father's saxophone to the club. And Kenny Garrett began to play for us on the saxophone he used as a boy, the one that had belonged to John Coltrane.
That was a gift. Thank you. John, thank you, Ravi.
One of my heroes, John Coltrane.
Wow. Got me on this one. Sorry about that.
Take your time. That was very emotional for you. What was going on while you played that saxophone?
When I was playing John Cole's horn, something came over me. I mean, not just the fact that it's John Coltrane's horn, but the vibration of this horn is taking me to a place. I'm playing and I'm feeling the spirit of Coltrane come out this horn. I'm putting this air in, but I'm still feeling like, wow, this is something different here. I think, you know, people, they leave their mark on these instruments.
When I think about the music that you do and the element of spirituality that you talk about, I think about music and I think about art and its ability to heal. Do you ever think about that? As you're composing, as you're performing, or do you ever feel that from the music itself?
Well, I believe the music does heal people. I think, you know, this music that we play, it's like a high you get. It's a place where you go to this zone. Everybody experiences it, but differently. And I think, you know, that's the reason that I play this music, because I know that it heals me, it heals my soul, it heals my spirit. And I know in turn, when we're playing, that's the idea that you want to convey to the audience. You want to play something for them to experience. I'm trying to lift the spirit. Because to me, music was always about trying to heal. There's still that one note is still about trying to heal people, trying to get to the soul. So I believe strongly that music heals.
your last album, Sounds from the Ancestors, is such a rich tapestry of music. What was the concept behind this?
Well, the concept behind Sounds from the Ancestors, I was really trying to capture that spirit. When I was a kid, I used to, I don't know how this tradition started, but I used to hide all my favorite 45s and 78s and albums. And then when Christmas Day would come, I would play this music and it would fill up my heart and soul. I was trying to capture that feeling. When you're a kid and you feel something and you don't know why it is, I didn't understand it, but I know that it was a love for music. And I wanted to have people experience that I had when I was a kid. And I was reaching for it, trying to, you know, conjure that back up. And so you have Sounds from the Ancestors song itself is really a combination of a lot of different genres, of classical, of Yoruban, of gospel, of everything I was trying to put into that song. But then I'm also, you have like a song I wrote for the late, you know, great Roy Hargrove. Then the song that I wrote for art's sake was really about Art Blakey. Once again, you know, trying to thank the elders, Art Blakey and Tony Allen. And I actually saw Tony Allen in France right before the pandemic, and I told him I'd written a song for him, but he never got a chance to hear it. I wanted to write some music for him because he was influenced by Art Blakey. And in turn, I figured, well, if he's influenced by Art Blakey, then I can write something for both of them. And so that's where you have like the African meets kind of jazz thing. And I think the thing is, I was just trying to bring it full circle.
That album won the NAACP Image Award, which had to have been really gratifying for you.
It was definitely gratifying. It was great because, I mean, you know, it's speaking to that. It's speaking to the history and the tradition of music and the ancestors. So that was really apropos.
Well, you have the ability to bring in all of these voices and honor that legacy, and yet at the same time be so contemporary.
Well, you know, I listen to everything. You know, I have my ears to the ground, listen to younger players. I'm listening to everything. I've always been that way. When I first came to New York, I could come and I can go to see five bands the same night. Because we started having like early hours where you start at 7 o'clock. So I would actually start at the Iridium, then head down to the Village Vanguard, then go to the Blue Note, then come back to Birdland. I can't do that now, but I would come over and I would hear all this music in one day. But I've always been curious about what other people were doing, but I also have a strong idea about what it is I want. But I like to be, you know, cognizant of what other people are hearing in the music, what they're trying to do.
Kenny, you have won many awards, and now you're an NEA Jazz Master. What does that mean for you?
Oh, that's great for me because it's an honor. I think about all of my heroes, Dizzy Gillespie and Miles Davis and Freddie Hubbard and Chick. These are people who I look up to, and to be in their company, to be honored by the NEA is really important for me. Because I feel like even though a lot of people kind of felt I was already there, it's official now. I'm part of that group, of that community of musicians, of the NEA Jazz Masters.
And it's more deserved than I can even begin to say.
Thank you.
Thank you for giving me your time, Kenny. And especially thank you for playing. That really meant a lot.
Thank you.
That was 2023 NEA Jazz Master, saxophonist, composer, and bandleader, Kenny Garrett. Many thanks to the Blue Note Jazz Club and to Robbie Coltrane. Keep up with Kenny and his concert schedule at kennygarrett.com. And you can find out more about the NEA Jazz Masters at arts.gov. You've been listening to Artworks, produced at the National Endowment for the Arts. We'd love to know your thoughts. Email us at artworkspod@arts.gov. And follow us wherever you get your podcasts. And leave us a rating on Apple because it helps other people who love the arts to find us. For the National Endowment for the Arts, I'm Josephine Reed. Thanks for listening.